Let's make it happen, Captain.
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome to Defrag. All right, and we've had our discussion for this morning, so let's just get started here. From Zippy B, from Zippy V, he says, I had to help a family member set up a new Windows 8 laptop over the internet, and I tried using Easy Connect feature in remote assistance. Unfortunately, he got an error which basically said, Easy Connect doesn't work with this network. Please try another network. I can't expect him to leave his home and connect to someone else's network. Emailing the invitation file wasn't an option because it wasn't set up yet. The question is there a way to troubleshoot this problem and get Easy Connect to work? Are there settings in Windows or other modem routers settings I should change? Some extra info, he connected to an Ethernet cable directly to his DSL modem. The problem was not on my side, as I've been able to connect with Easy Connect with other people, and the Sony Vaio laptop came with some software which might have changed some network settings from the OEM.
So clearly this wasn't a brand new Windows installation, it was an OEM installation.
Yeah.
AV software can interfere with this. I've seen that happen before, firewall, third-party firewall software. Even, you know, Windows firewall software, if it's been misconfigured, can definitely cause this.
Yeah.
Without actually knowing what the network setup is, and without actually digging into that computer, it'll be very difficult to say for that particular machine what you need to do to get Easy Connect working.
Yeah.
However, that being said, it's kind of an interesting segue. Like, this kind of problem generally comes up pretty often. Like, I think we both set up multiple machines for various people. One of the things that I do on it is set up remote access to it.
Yeah.
So that it's pretty much always available in case they have problems with it in a secure way. A lot of people like to use an SSH client to do this. Windows actually comes with its own SSH-like remote access to it, which I find actually significantly more powerful because you can actually run PowerShell scripts along with it. It's called Windows Remote Management, WinRM. And it's actually pretty easy to set up. I've got some instructions here, so I don't have to keep going back and forth with setting it up at the command prompt. So what you want to do first is actually start the service. So you go to services.msc, and you have Windows Remote Management here. Set it to start. And then you want to set it up for auto start. So you do that, that will make it come up. Okay, and then here, it's actually really simple. You just do WinRM quick config. It's already running, is not set up to allow remote access to this machine. Following changes must be made. Do you want to make these changes? And in fact, yes, I do. It's created a listener. Now, what's happened is it'll create a default listener on the HTTP port, and it'll allow requests to any IP address on this machine. What you can do is to change the default settings via the WinRM command, and there's lots of different settings to go through. What I'm not going to go through all of them. I'm not going to go through the entire configuration. There is a KB article. Or a TechNet article for configuration of remote management. Basically, search for article AA384372.
Okay.
It'll go through the detailed configuration of this. Now, on the client side, what you'll want to do in order to connect to a remote machine is go WinRS and the remote server name. So I'm just going to go foo. This is not going to work, obviously, because I don't have it. And then the actual command that you're going to want to do. So this will do, you know, a directory of the C drive
yeah.
on that remote server. Now, this works really well if you've already got default security set up, so in a domain environment.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a workgroup environment, you're going to have to set up the ability on the client machine to actually talk to that server machine. And you do that also with the WinRM command, set WinRM config client at curly brace trusted hosts. and then your server name, whichever client or the server name that you're trying to connect to. So you'd go foo, you know, bar, blah, semicolon delimited, and then with a close, actually you need quotes in here. There. So you would do that. It would now say that those trusted hosts, here are the ports because it's WinRM2.0. These are the ports that you have to have enabled on the server machines to have them enabled to connect to them. So it's 5985 on HTTP, 5986 for HTTPS. This is just a very simple way of setting up WinRM. I find this extremely handy on people's machines. Now, you might ask, well, foo, bar, that doesn't really help over the internet.
Yeah.
Now, the wonderful thing about WinRM is that you can actually connect over IPv6. And IPv6 is addressable on the internet, and you don't actually have to have their IPv4 IP address. So you can do this also via IPv4 address if you set it up with Dyn DNS. If you knew their router's IPv4 address, you can connect to it that way, as long as you've done a port forward.
Yeah.
You don't need to do port forwards if you have the IPv6 address. Now, if you want to enable PNRP on your machine, so if I wanted to enable PNRP on this machine, I would do netsh, p2p, PNRP, peer, set, machine, publish. We don't make these commands very easy, do we?
No, but Graham will get through that, no problem.
Well, see, this is why I would never tell an end user to do it. I would go set up their machine, set this up, and not have them worry about it at all. Of course, this is definitely the I'm not using any third-party software in order to do it kind of thing.
Yep. No, Grandma, the curly brace, you know. No, the curly brace.
Auto-publish equals enable. Wonderful feedback.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. We're good.
To determine what your PNRP address is, netsh, p2p, PNRP, peer, show, machine. That's my machine name. Okay.
Grandma just had a stroke.
So the actual way to refer to this machine is p dot this long string, okay, dot pnrp.net. That's its DNS name.
Yeah.
So you can actually refer to this machine. So write that down. And you can use Easy Assist to refer to this particular machine this way. You can also use WinRM to refer to this machine this way, because that's its DNS name.
Yeah.
This is, yes, absolutely complex. Thankfully, if you are setting up people's machines in this manner, you're the only one that needs to know this information.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And I do this. Like, I set this up on numerous people's machines, so when they have a problem, just say, look, make sure it's connected to the net. Can you go do something on the net?
Yeah.
Yay, great. Let's see if I can get this working again for you. So remote shell, very handy with the remote shell. You can do things like reset adapters, you know, reset state. You can re-enable remote desktop if it was disabled. And I believe in our previous shows, we've talked about how to access a machine through remote desktop over the internet.
Yep.
Don't want to go over that one again.
Yeah, yeah.
Look at a previous show.
Okay.
But this is definitely the cooler command line way that I prefer of connecting to a remote machine anywhere on the net that I've configured.
Yeah, and the way that I've done it in the past, Dad, install CrossLoop. Give me your number.
There are,
log
of
on
course,
that way, and then do the more complex stuff and then, by the way, uninstall CrossLoop.
Yeah, there's definitely simpler third-party software solutions. There's TeamViewer, which I know a lot of people like.
Yeah.
CrossLoop, Saludo.
Uh-huh.
That one has a little bit more monitoring software on it as well. You know, it's not just remote management. Yep. Intune is another one. That's ours, Microsoft's one. Subscription-based, again, very handy for remote management systems. You know, if you're a small business OEM and you're, and you're also doing your solution provider doing that, it could actually be very handy to do an Intune account.
Yeah.
So you can have your customers, you know, pay you for the service. You know, I don't know what you would charge, but... you know, it's the value add kind of thing, right? It's like if you're going to personally look after that machine, which I know a lot of OEMs actually don't really do.
I was a big fan of Mesh back in the day.
I was a huge fan of Mesh. I'd rather not go into it.
All right, next question from Steven. I took the plunge and saw Windows 8 Pro upgrade from Vista, and it went without problems. I've been using Windows 8 for several weeks with no problems, except for finding my way around. But the last few days, the majority of my apps have stopped working. Clicking on a tile and the flash screen appears, but then reverts back to the start screen. Only the App Store app works correctly, along with the Xbox app. Not all the live tiles are working correctly either. There seems to be a lot of similar reports online, mostly to do with incorrect permissions, but I'm reluctant to follow this advice for obvious reasons.
So, really, store apps will not just suddenly start failing for no reason, right? So, usually what it is something on the desktop. You've installed a desktop piece of software that has done something, and it's usually messing with regkey permissions or file system permissions. I can show you some file system permissions. Let's see, Windows System 32. Yeah. We look at those properties and we look at security. One of the things that's on it is all application packages.
Yeah.
So this particular permission can be removed for, you know, various reasons. Some software will incorrectly reset permissions, and this will stop some apps from working. You'll have crashes, you'll have completely bizarre behavior. And that is unfortunately very difficult to determine what in the system has lost its permission, or what file is missing, you know, what's been overwritten, whatever, by a third-party piece of software. Now, the scorched earth scenario is you reset your PC. So Windows 8, under settings, change PC settings, general. Yeah, here we go. You can refresh your PC without affecting your files. You can remove everything and reinstall Windows. This is your scorched earth.
Yeah.
This one will not affect your personal files. It will not affect your Windows Store apps. It will wipe out everything else. You can try this one first. If that one doesn't work, you can try this one. Again, these are your last resorts.
Yeah.
Before doing that, there is the Windows Store App Troubleshooter. So here's a off of the Microsoft or Windows.com website. You know, most people have already done through the basic things, you know, trying to update your app, reinstall, sync, yada, yada. Most of the time, that really doesn't help.
Yeah.
We got to put it there, but it doesn't really help. If you go all the way to the bottom, there's this apps troubleshooter that you can download. Okay, so what you want to do, this is using our built-in troubleshooter software. These can get updated all the time. What you want to do is choose this, choose advanced, repair automatically, run as administrator. It'll do it again. Apply repairs automatically. Hit next. Keep following through. I don't actually need to do it here. And a lot of the time, since this troubleshooter is constantly being updated, this could actually resolve your problems for you.
Cool. Okay. All right. From Eddie, I've read about the fact that some cores are being parked in Windows 7 and checked on my PC, and indeed some of my cores are parked. I read online that when the power plant is set to performance, it shouldn't happen that it's meant for laptops anyway. Well, my PC isn't a laptop, and my power plant is set to performance, but the resource monitor shows at least three cores are constantly parked. I have Windows 7 SP1 64-bit, Core i7 quad-core. I've downloaded a utility. It changes the registry, so all the cores are active and not parked. I wanted to run it by you and make sure that it won't harm my PC. Electricity isn't an issue.
Well, I beg to differ. Electricity is always the issue. You know, I wouldn't call myself a tree hugger, but I like to save power when I can. Or at least I don't like to waste power if it's not actually required.
Yeah.
The Windows Scheduler is going to allocate your cores correctly for you. If there's things that can be done in a multi-threaded fashion, it'll spin up a core as needed and will schedule it. Now, what you've done is you bypass that so that all your cores are active, or supposedly active. But if the scheduler is not scheduling anything on it, you're not going to get the benefit. You're just getting power wasting.
Yeah.
So is there any real harm? No, not really. I mean, you're just negating some of the power-saving features that the OS is trying to give you.
Yeah.
If you're using, like, a heavy-duty game, assuming that it's a multi-threaded game, and, you know, a lot of the more current games are not actually CPU-bound, but they're graphics-bound. So they're actually, you know, your video card is the thing that's going full bore, not your CPU. So you may even notice cores being parked if you're playing a game, but, you know, that's not actually a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So disabling core parking, you're not going to cause any harm, but you will be wasting power.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Next question from Martin. He's talking about he has two displays. One of them's in portrait. One's 1920 by 1080. The other 1200 by 1920. The one that's in portrait. And when he moves his mouse from one to the other, it shows up in the middle of the screen. Doesn't prefer that. So we were talking about
this. Got something like this going on.
You can say one of them's in portrait. Say the middle one.
Sure. And different resolutions.
Yeah.
So the problem is, you know, he's got them physically aligned, but physically aligned doesn't actually help because the resolution is completely wrong. Like this resolution is going to be completely different from this in portrait mode resolution.
Yeah.
So if you're scrolling across the top or off the middle or whatever, going from one screen to another, it's going to be at a different vertical point on the screen. So yeah, you're going to hit up against an edge. And is there a way to, you know, stop that? Not really.
Well, you can go into the screen properties and adjust how the screens are aligned, and you can set your top edges to match each other.
Right.
And that's going to let you drag
pick
across.
An edge.
You have to pick what's going to happen.
Because normally it's probably going to be aligned to the bottom edge.
Yeah.
You know, if you flip this one portrait and you've got it physically aligned at the top, but in your display properties, I've got it duplicated here, so it's not going to show it properly. And if I change it, the screen cap is going to go nutso. But if you've got multiple displays, you're going to see two. I can point right here. You'd see two displays.
Yeah.
And you can actually physically move them. You can just click your mouse and move them around. You can switch their places.
Mm-hmm.
And as they align, you can, as Larry's saying, you can align either the top edge or the bottom edge so that if you're going back and forth, it will...
whichever you prefer. I like to take the one that has the start button on Windows 7 and bring it a little bit lower anyway, because then my mouse catches when I go down to the corner, and I can always hit the start button easily.
Right.
But, I mean, it's completely up to the user. Whatever works for you. All right, from Dave Will, I need to know the scope of what Microsoft Security Essentials scans when performing a quick scan. I pulled out a resource monitor elevated and filtered on MSMP-ENG to take a look-see. While process monitors showed lots of lovely stuff, I wonder, did it show it all? Who has the lowest hook, Procmon or MSE? Who's hiding from who?
Well, Procmon will definitely not show everything. It can't show everything. MSE is just a driver, right? So it is going to be doing things that Procmon and ResourceMon won't necessarily show because they're not looking for those types of things.
Yeah.
In terms of who has the lowest hook, it's kind of an interesting question. There are things that a kernel-level driver is doing that you're just not looking out for.
Yeah.
And you don't necessarily need to look out for it. You know, if you actually want to trace what a kernel driver is doing, you need to hook up a kernel debugger. Mm-hmm. And that's really all you can do, you know, if you're trying to trace what it's doing.
Yeah.
So there's going to be more individual, smaller packet-sized operations that are happening in the driver that a gross level monitor like procmon and resourcemon just simply won't show.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Okay. Next question. Recently, when I connect my digital camera, the camera screen shows that it's connected to the computer, but nothing else happens. I've been downloading pictures previously with no problem. How do I re-enable autoplay?
Okay. So you can do this by going to Control Panel, going to Programs, going to Default Programs, change autoplay settings. You can choose exactly what to do.
Camera storage is probably a good place to start.
Yep. So it probably would happen to something that said take no action.
Yeah.
Got clicked. And you probably want to change that to either ask me every time or do something.
Yeah, sometimes when things pop up, you do always do this and then didn't mean to do that. You can come in here and change it.
Exactly.
Cool. All right, next question. I'd like some programs and ports, namely IRC, for my Windows 7 computer to send traffic through a VPN, while the other programs, web browsing, FTP, etc., should default to not using the VPN and send data over my ISP like normal. Is this possible to do on Windows 7, or do I need to run something on my router? If possible, what's the best way to go about setting this up?
This person is talking about setting up a split tunnel VPN. Windows will not do split tunnel based on particular process or particular ports, but it sounds like you'd need a third-party VPN software that will actually be able to configure that for you, and you'd probably have to set up some sort of local DNS server on your machine so that when IRC is trying to talk to what it believes to be the IRC server, it actually talks to your own server first and then forwards on the packets.
Yeah.
I don't believe there's a way to configure Windows on its own in order to do this, but you may be able to do it if you had, like, server.
Yeah.
And with all of its extra goodies, but I don't believe a client machine can do this on its own.
Okay. Next question. I have an HP Pavilion DV6. I need more volume what my laptop's integrated default sound card and software will offer. Will an external USB sound card resolve this, or do I need to upgrade the software? Volume for integrated speakers is acceptable, but I need more volume on my headphones, which are a decent pair. So we've got a lot of different options here.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the first one that I do, if I don't have anything else with me, is just try to run whatever it is I'm trying to listen to in VLC, and then it lets me boost the volume up to 200%, which is usually enough to give me the volume that I'm looking for with a pair of headphones. But we both have different methods that we use for this as well.
Yeah, I don't know if you've also seen... let's see, playback devices, properties, enhancements. So you can actually, sometimes some cards have additional enhancements in here for getting a little bit louder. And levels, you know, you want to make sure that your levels are up, that your balance is correct.
Yeah, levels on your PC and the application you're using.
Right, so that's basically all you can do for inbox software.
Yeah.
What you use is this guy, right?
Yeah, I use a Boosteroo. It's a generic version of it that I think came from Radio Shack. It's the little one down here by Amplifiers.
And that
it's,
one?
Yeah, it's just a little headphone amp. And we use one here in the studio as well. This lets you drive three different sets of headphones off one volume port. So I kind of like that. And it also boosts the volume a little bit, which is kind of nice. There's not a dedicated volume on this device, but, you know, you just use the volume on your PC. So that's the main way. And I'll also include a link to just some other generic devices like this, too. And you just look up headphone amp. That's basically what you're looking for.
Yeah.
I wouldn't use an external USB sound card. That is not the right tool.
No, it's definitely overkill. The other thing you can do is a USB DAC. So the one disadvantage of the Boosteroo or those types of devices is that they will boost the analog signal and you'll get, you know, potentially some more buzz and hum and interference and noise.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of external DACs, you're actually going to plug in via USB, you're getting the raw digital signal, and then you're amplifying that out. So this E10 USB DAC headphone amp, highly recommended. I've got one of these. And that's going to be a really easy and clean way to do it. Definitely more expensive.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're an audiophile, this is going to be probably something that you'd want more. But if you're just needing it for, you know, on the go kind of thing, you're just needing to boost on a plane.
Booster, or you want to boost the sound on your phone.
Or yeah, like the other advantage is that the booster, you can move to non-computer devices,
yeah,
which is very, very handy. USB DAC, I've seen some that actually come with their built-in battery, so you don't have to even power it off the computer. It'll have its own built-in power. So you got a bunch of different options.
Yeah, and then the last one I'd point out too is if you go to CNET download, there's a bunch of different apps.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to do what VLC does. I'll just link to that because I haven't tried any of them, and I can't tell you, you know, how good or bad they are.
Right.
And I'd even question, like, what are they doing to get better sound? Is it really just going to, you know, amplify to the point of noise or what? But you can try those out. See if there's a free one with a trial, and if that works for you, that might be an option as well. All right, next question. I have a RAR that is hidden, and I want to add more files to it with WinRAR, preferably, without making visible. Is there a way to do this with command or batch file?
I want to say maybe,
yeah,
at best. Now, you can set up a batch file that will call a trib and unhide it, run your WinRAR, do that, do whatever it is that you want to do, and then rehide it again.
Yeah.
WinRAR has a command line version of it. You can also batch file that as well. It may be able to just simply read, like from the command line, it may simply be able to read the hidden file directly without having to use a trib to unhide it.
Yeah, and without applying our own guess of why they're trying to do this, are you hiding it because you just want to keep your system clean looking and you don't want to see the icon? Are you hiding it for obfuscation purposes where you don't want someone to see it?
Right.
In which case you have different things that you might do. In this case, I would probably just make a shortcut to the WinRAR,
yeah,
and then you can even set up a Windows, you know, shortcut key that you just hit a keyboard thing and it just pops up, and you can drag the new file into that WinRAR window when it comes up.
Right.
So it depends on the reason that the user's using. All right, we got one more question. Other than scheduling the time for execution to be in the near future, is there a way for the Windows 7 task scheduler to force a future task to execute now for the purpose of testing and observing if it to ensure that it works as desired?
Absolutely. Right click, run.
Easy as eating lettuce.
Sorry, I should actually said, you run task scheduler first.
Yeah, yeah.
And if I really wanted to show everything, task, schedule, under settings, run schedule tasks, blah. That brings up this. It will default to this main page. You know, find your task. It's under the task scheduler library at the main section, or in maybe you created a new subfolder.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah, just right-click on it and say run.
Cool.
That's
okay.
It.
All right, and it's pick of the week time now, and the pick of the week is the Depth Sensor Shootout. So this is from Stimulant.io, and it's a kind of interesting look at several different depth sensors. You've got the Kinect, you got the Leap Motion, and there's an Intel one that is new on the scene. The other two, the Leap Motion and the Intel one, are a little bit newer. I mean, Kinect's been out for 3 years now.
3 years, yeah.
So they've got the advantage of being a little bit newer device, but there's always new things coming from Kinect. And you can look at the differences. I mean, they are very different, and they're used for different purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Long story short here, if you need to do a stand-up skeletal tracking, Kinect is pretty much the only game in town. The Leap
for
is
now.
Really good for now. The Leap is really good for fingertips, and it says the Intel's good for voice, I think.
Mm.
But I question, why not Kinect for voice? Because it has a microphone array on it. And if you, there's some interviews I've done with the Kinect team who built that microphone array,
mm-hmm.
and it's really interesting. the things that they can do with it, they can tell exactly where in space the voice is coming from and stuff like that. So I think that voice on Kinect is something that hasn't been tapped to its full potential yet. And
well, the interesting thing to remember also about the Kinect is it's able to handle multiple people in its view, both in the camera and in the microphone.
Mm-hmm.
The other two, I believe, are designed for close-up single person.
Yeah.
So again, very different purposes.
Yeah.
I definitely see a time when, you know, this type of interface is just going to be melded together,
mm-hmm.
where you will have multiple devices, or perhaps as a single device.
Yeah.
But, you know, multiple cameras that are able to handle the skeletal side of things or close up.
Yeah.
In order to be, you know, fully immersive.
Yeah, why not all three? Let's see what you can do with a whole bunch of different devices. But it's an interesting look at some of the different sensors, and you can get an idea of where they shine and where they lack, and
mm-hmm.
there you have it. So that's the show for this week. If you have a question, you can send an email to defragshow@microsoft.com. You can leave a comment in the show notes, and we'll get back to you there, but we prefer the email so we can go back and forth, and we'll see you next week.
Take care.